The American Revolution. The ultimate conflict that we call the American Revolution resulted from the proximate cause of American resistance to the coercive acts of 1774. As we've seen, in 1773, colonists in the Port of Boston in Massachusetts Bay Colony had dumped tea from the ship Dartmouth into Boston Harbor. This tea was the property of the East India Company, special favorite of the British Parliament, and the colonists decided that one way to protest the parliamentary attempts to establish the principle of parliamentary taxation in North America was by dumping that tea into the harbor. Well, at that point, Parliament finally decided, after more than a decade of disputation, well, nearly a decade of disputation, that it had had enough of the colonists. In particular, people in the British political establishment thought that their difficulties in North America centered on two groups of people. That is, a group of troublemakers headquartered in Boston and associated with the speaker of, that is, the moderator of the Boston town meeting, Sam Adams. And on the other hand, Tidewater Virginia planters. In one case, British officialdom deduced that the reason for the resistance was a desire of devout Puritans to make difficulty for their Anglican overlords in the mother country. And in the other case, it seemed that selfish planters just didn't want to pay any taxes. At least that's the way that the British understood things. And actually, they expected that if matters came to a head, ultimately there would be significant support for His Majesty's government in North America. So they adopted a suite of laws called the Coercive Acts, all of them intended as retribution and as a way of coercing the government of Massachusetts Bay Colony, and at the same time restructuring the government to make it more pliable. So the first of the Coercive Acts was what was called the Massachusetts Government Act. And what it said was that from now on, rather than having the lower house of the Massachusetts General Court be elected by the people in their town meetings and the upper house elected by the lower house would be elected by the people in their town meetings, but the upper house would be selected by the governor. And instead of having a Republican governorship, as they had had in Massachusetts virtually throughout the colony's history, from that point on, the governor would be appointed by the king. So you had, instead of a bottom-up structure of government, a top-down, actually a dictatorship of the king. And this was especially evident when it became clear who the first royally appointed governor of Massachusetts Bay Colony was going to be, and that was the commander of His Majesty's forces in North America, General Sir Thomas Gage. The second of the Coercive Acts was the Boston Port Act, and its purpose was just to close the port of Boston. Here the idea was that eventually the people in Massachusetts Bay Colony, or at least people in Boston, should compensate the East India Company for the loss of its tea. Now, to this point in Massachusetts, there had been essentially two groupings of people among the indigenous population. That is, if you left aside Governor Thomas Hutchinson and the coterie around him, essentially people in Massachusetts divided into two groups, those who were radically opposed to British policy and those who were opposed but disapproved of the radicals' tactics. A notable member of that latter group was John Adams, Sam Adams' cousin, who was an attorney in Boston, and who definitely disagreed of the illegal tactics to which Sam and his followers sometimes resorted. But what happened in this case was that when John Adams heard of the Boston Port Act, he switched sides and became a devoted advocate of the idea of independence for Massachusetts Bay Colony. Because, as John understood it, closing the port of Boston violated one of the basic English legal principles, that of punishing people who are guilty of a crime after they've been convicted following due process of law. if the port of Boston were closed, it wasn't only people who were actually guilty or even responsible for the so-called Tea Party of December 1773 who were going to suffer. And it wasn't even only people who were in Boston who were going to suffer. It was people in the entire region. Boston in those days was even more central to the economy and society of New England than it is today. So if you were a wheat grower in New Hampshire, or if you were a farmer in western Massachusetts, or perhaps in northern Rhode Island or northeastern Connecticut, chances are that you imported and exported things through the Port of Boston. Closing it up then was apt to hurt you too. And again, this seemed to John Adams to violate the most basic of English legal principles. And so from that point on, John decided he was rather more sympathetic to his cousin's tactics than he had been before. A third of these coercive acts, which Sam Adams dubbed the Intolerable Acts, was the Administration of Justice Act. And what this law said was that from that point on, if the governor decided that it was necessary to do so, he could transfer the trial of any British official or any British personnel in Massachusetts who was accused of a capital crime to any other place in the British Empire. So if, for example, on a future occasion, there was another so-called massacre in Boston, and people were indicted, say British soldiers were indicted for murder, the governor could say, well, we're not going to have these people be tried in Boston before a jury of Bostonians. Instead, we'll move this trial somewhere else in the British Empire, and it's possible that these people wouldn't even be tried before a jury at all. Actually, the Parliament had recently created a new Admiralty Court in Halifax, Nova Scotia, just northeast of Maine, which at that time was part of Massachusetts. And the distinguishing characteristic of Admiralty courts, as far as the colonists were concerned, was that they sat without juries. Juries were a feature of the common law courts in England. An Admiralty court didn't have such restraint on the professional judges who presided over them. And so here, once again, we see people in Massachusetts being given fit ground for grievance that they're being deprived of the rights of Englishmen, among those rights being, as we've seen colonists insisting all the way back to the Stamp Act Congress of 1765, the right to trial by jury. Finally, the fourth of the so-called intolerable acts was the Quartering Act, and what it did was to say that in case Massachusetts failed to provide adequate quarters for British military personnel on the request of British military officers, then those officers would be free to grab private buildings for their troops' quartering. This seemed an awful augury of future purloining of households, and of course was apt to meet with spirited resistance from people in Massachusetts. Besides these laws, which struck not only people in Massachusetts, but also people in Virginia who were sympathetic with them, especially in the Virginia political elite, as simply offensive and, as I said before, intolerable. Another law was finally passed by Britain at this time by a very awful coincidence. That was the Quebec Act. As we've seen in 1763, Britain had finally won the First World War, that's what I call it at least. It was actually, it's known to history as the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War. And among the spoils of war was what was then called Canada, which we now call Quebec. Of course, Quebec was a gigantic territory full of every kind of natural resource. But another thing it was full of were Frenchmen. And the question that faced the British, having conquered this territory, was, well, how are we going to govern these Frenchmen? Shall we impose on them the same state church and the same local institutions as we have in England? And the answer that the British Parliament finally arrived at with the King's consent in 1774 was, well, no, they wouldn't. They wouldn't make these Catholics attend and pay for the King's Protestant church, but instead would allow them to keep their Catholic religion, and actually the King would help to enforce it. Besides that, they were going to be allowed to keep their traditional French-style local government institutions. Now, on one hand, this strikes today as an eminently reasonable and one might say liberal way of treating these conquered people. But from the point of view of some people in the rest of the North American colonies, and especially in New England, and most particularly Sam Adams and the people around him in Boston, this was a threat because their worldview said that the King of England was always, and people in English authority were always going to be working to undermine the Puritan experiment, ultimately stamp out Puritanism so that they could force people to become Anglicans as the King's government was. And here was supposed proof of it. And in fact, another element of the Quebec Act was to extend the boundaries of Quebec all the way down to the Ohio River. So at a stroke, the colonial boundary between Virginia and Quebec, Canada, was moved all the way across the Midwest, what's today the Midwestern part of the United States, so that rather than Virginia including that territory, now according to the King, Quebec did. Well, what to do here? The response of Massachusetts was to call for a Continental Congress. And ultimately, the other colonies decided to participate in this Continental Congress. The first Continental Congress met in 1774 and 75. The second Continental Congress was going to meet from 1775 to 81. Now, the first Continental Congress was dominated by moderates. Really, once the delegates assembled in Philadelphia, they found at least the separatists, patriots as they called themselves, found that their numbers were confined mainly to the delegations of Massachusetts and Virginia. So you have people like Patrick Henry, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington in the Virginia delegation, and then obviously on the other side you have John Hancock, Sam Adams, John Adams, leading lights of independence in this first Continental Congress. But it was dominated, as I said before, by moderates, people who still hoped there could be a rapprochement between the colonies and the mother country. And those people were dominated by John Dickinson of Pennsylvania, who insisted that there be yet another of what there had been a whole series of through the 1760s and 70s, another petition, what came to be called the Olive Branch Petition, drafted by Dickinson in company with John Jay of New York, another moderate. Actually, Jay's moderation is understandable in light of the fact that it was the British only a couple of generations before who had given asylum to his Protestant family at the time of its expulsion from France for being Protestant. So Jay was very pro-British. He was a patriotic Briton in that sense and did not want to break with the mother country if it were all possible not to. So the first Continental Congress took these last steps to try to please moderates, to try to exhaust every opportunity for some kind of, as I said before, rapprochement, some kind of working out of the grievances of the moderates, I'm sorry, of the colonists. But on April 19, 1775, despite the intentions of people who dominated the Congress, fighting between the mother country and the colonies began. What happened was that General Gage had heard that the two chief troublemakers in Massachusetts, John Hancock and Sam Adams, were hiding out in Lexington, Concord, which was in those days even a short march from Boston to the west. And he also had heard that the colony's chief store of gunpowder, that is the colonial militia's chief store of gunpowder, had been relocated to Concord, which was farther up the road to Lexington. So on the morning of April 19, 1775, at Governor General Gage's instigation, the party of British soldiers and Marines set out up the road to Concord. Their intention was to arrest John Hancock and Sam Adams on their way. But what happened en route was that, of course, by this point, Paul Revere had already gone out and warned people that the British were coming. So ultimately, at Lexington, there was a confrontation in which, at the end, several Americans were killed. And then the British force, John Hancock and John Adams, I'm sorry, and Sam Adams were not there because they had been warned by Revere that the British were coming. But ultimately, the British marched on up to Concord, where they were given a bloody nose and forced to retreat to Boston. On their way back to Boston, they were beset by men from the countryside surrounding the road to Boston. And when they got to Boston, they found themselves in control. And Governor Gage, from that point, was in control really not of Massachusetts Bay Colony, but just of the city of Boston itself. And his city was ringed by the assembled men of New England, essentially. So at this point, the Continental Congress, the first one still, set about taking steps in response to this. First of all, it sought to find alliances. This would be the chief work, actually, of the Second Continental Congress, finding alliances. It also named George Washington, one of the members of the Continental Congress, to be commander-in-chief of what was now being called the Continental Army. That is this force of essentially militiamen, or might say common citizens, who had gone to ring the city of Boston and keep the British from marching out into the countryside again. The Continental Congress was also, the second one, was also going to be responsible for a major reform that still affects us every day, and that is at the instigation of a delegate from Virginia, Thomas Jefferson. It decided that the Americans should have a decimal currency system based on the Spanish dollar. The Spanish dollar was 8 grains of silver, which is something like 3.6 ounces. Don't quote me on that, but anyway, 8 grains of silver were a Spanish dollar milled amount, which was the common coinage of Spanish colonies in the Caribbean. And you can see some remnant in American English of the fact that our dollar was originally 8 grains of silver by the fact that even today people commonly call a quarter 2 bits. Well, why would a quarter be 2 bits? And the answer is, well, if there are 8 grains of silver in a dollar, then a quarter would be 2 grains of silver, right? 2 bits. So America became the first society with a decimal coinage. Ultimately, this idea would sweep the world. And in our lifetime, even Britain itself finally has adopted this decimal system. You can get some idea of what an important reform this was by recalling the way that British currency worked at the time that Jefferson suggested the Continental Congress adopt this standard. In those days, the British pound sterling was divisible into 8 shillings, each of which was divisible into 16 pence. So you had 128 pence per pound. You had 8 shillings per pound. Try manipulating those figures a little bit, and you'll see that surely Jefferson's system was quite an improvement. Well, on July 6, 1775, several months after the fighting had started, Congress issued what was called the Declaration of the Causes and Necessity of Taking Up Arms, chiefly the work of Thomas Jefferson again. This was a very pugnacious, kind of confrontational explanation why the Americans were standing up for their rights, that they had had no choice, as I said, causes and necessity of taking up arms. But they were trying to explain to the British populace that it wasn't that we wanted to do this, it's that your government has left us no choice and we would be happy for a change in your government's policy. Well, they also hoped that this might appeal to King George to intervene with his ministry and force the ministry to cease military operations in North America. But what George did instead was that on August 23rd, 1775, he issued a royal proclamation. People in America called this the Royal Proclamation. Of course, there were many royal proclamations back in the day when the King of England was a significant player in British politics, but in America, this was the Royal Proclamation. And what the king essentially said was that the people who were resisting parliamentary policy in North America were in rebellion, and that every right-minded citizen of every right-minded subject of his throne was responsible for resisting people who were in rebellion and for bringing them to justice. Soon after this, during debates in Congress, there was a kind of contretemps among, that is, a major disagreement among some of the members. And Ben Franklin, the most famous man in America at the time, after sitting silently through much debate, which he made a point of doing, finally interjected to say, "Gentlemen, gentlemen, we must all hang together, or we shall certainly all hang separately." Right? And the point is that once the king declared that the colonies were in rebellion, everybody who was a member of the Continental Congress, not to mention General Washington and his subordinate officers, all of these people were traitors. The punishment at English common law for treason was to be hanged by the neck until almost dead, to be cut down, to be eviscerated, to watch one's innards burn before one's face, and then to be drawn and quartered, a process that involved having each of one's limbs tied to a horse, and the horses all four then told, "Giddy up." So this was a punishment definitely to be avoided, and you can understand why it would have seemed quite a bracing prospect for somebody like Franklin or Jefferson or any of the other people who were members of the Continental Congress. But you might think after July 6, 1775's declaration of causes and necessity of taking up arms, and then King George's August 23, 1775 royal proclamation, word of which made its way to North America a few weeks later, you might have thought that the American Congress would instantly proceed to declare independence. And yet, although the fighting began on April 19, 1775, as we know, it wasn't until July 4, 1776 that the American colonists got around to declaring their independence. Why did it take so long? Well, there are several reasons. First of all, Americans were blaming the Parliament for the problems, not the king. They made a distinction between Parliament's role in North America, which, rightly, as they understood, should be nothing, and the king's role in North America, and devoted patriots like Thomas Jefferson had argued in 1774, as I mentioned in a past lecture, that the king was, properly speaking, the king not only of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, Jamaica, India, Bahamas, Canada, but also of Connecticut, Virginia, South Carolina, Georgia, and so on, right? New York, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania. And so their hope was that, well, they could continue to appeal to the king as through the olive branch petition, and perhaps the king would decide to intervene with his parliament to prevent, by exercising his veto, to prevent the parliament from exercising its military policy in North America. Another reason why people delayed declaring independence, despite the fact that the fighting had started, was that they hoped their parliamentary allies might win the argument. There were several prominent people in each house of the British Parliament who sided with the colonial arguments, even if they weren't in favor, as somebody like Edmund Burke, say, in the House of Commons, was not in favor of independence. He certainly did argue that the colonists had every right to resist British policy. And as he put it in one speech in the House of Commons, if you were in their position, you would behave as they are. You would not allow them to take your hereditary rights away from you either. So there were people like Burke and Lord Chatham, the former William Pitt in the Lords, Wilkes and Barre in the House of Commons, who all sided with the Americans. Now, this was actually a kind of pipe dream. There never was really any substantial number of people in either House of Parliament who were siding with the Americans, but the Americans hoped that they could avoid independence. Why would they want to avoid independence? Well, because for one thing, they were patriotic, they were British. Virtually all these people had been born British, and they liked being British. Why wouldn't you? For one thing, being British meant you were free. You were freer than citizen of virtually any other country in Europe, not to mention the rest of the world, China, Turkey, India. Far better you should be British. Besides that, being in the British Empire was a very lucrative proposition. So if you were a tobacco planter in Maryland, likely your markets were in France and Scotland, maybe England itself, and you didn't want to break with the English because then you wouldn't have the same access to the markets you were used to as you'd had before. So why not try to work out the problems? Another reason why they delayed declaring independence was that a declaration of independence would mean a war. Definitely the war would go on, and there was a good chance that the colonists would lose the war. After all, Britain had just defeated France. Britain was the foremost military power in the world. Why would you want to fight them? If it could be avoided, it should be avoided. And even if you won the war, well, that wouldn't necessarily be much better. Because in the 18th century, of course, if you were going to win a war, you had to have an army. And if you had an army and you won a war, you had a victorious conquering general. And victorious conquering generals in the European world in the 18th century weren't called former general. They were typically called something like duke or tsar or wa or king or Grand Duke or Pope or something. That is, you were liable to end up with a dictatorship. You might very well be exchanging the relatively good constitution you had as part of the British Empire for something far more undesirable outside the British Empire. So ultimately, the Americans did declare independence, of course, but it took them a while to get to it because this was an awful, in the old-fashioned sense, a really awe-inspiring, dreadful prospect. Now, when the war started, people had certain expectations. One goal that they had for the army, the Continental Army, which was the first American institution, and George Washington, of course, was the first symbol of America. One goal that they had for the army was that it should conquer Canada. Or actually, they hoped that the Canadians, hearing of independence, would say, well, we'd like to be independent too. Why wouldn't they? After all, the Frenchmen in Canada were conquered people. But of course, this left out the fact that the Frenchmen in Canada were perfectly aware of the propaganda that was coming out of the Continental Congress. And people like John Jay, as president of the Continental Congress, were doing things like referring to the colonies that were fighting against the British as these United Protestant Colonies. Well, if you're a Catholic in then Canada, which is now called Quebec, essentially, why would you want to exchange this very indulgent, although Protestant, King of England for these anti-Catholic people like John Jay? You didn't really know what kind of situation you'd be getting into. So besides that, people in Canada didn't think they were being oppressed. And we're going to see this is an idea that's come back in American history over and over, the idea of annexing Canada. But anyway, the Americans also hoped that their army would go out and, like the Austrian or the Russian or the Spanish or the French army, meet the British army on battlefields and win set battles with them. Washington decided early on in the war wisely that he would adopt a strategy akin to that adopted by the ancient Roman military figure Fabius, who, seeing that his Roman armies were constantly being obliterated by Hannibal of Carthage, finally decided, well, the solution to this is just not to fight. Whenever Hannibal's in the area of one of our Roman cities, we'll just retreat within the walls and wait for them to pass, which ultimately proved to be a successful strategy. Another way of putting that is, we Americans live here, and it costs the British a lot of money to have an army here. So if we can just keep our army in being, eventually the British will get tired of paying for this war. Sound familiar? Right? If you studied American military history, you might have had some idea how various other American military ventures would turn out. But anyway, Washington decided on this strategy, which was going to thwart the will of people who hoped that Americans would just go out and fight major set battles against the British. Not to say that Washington never did that. And there were some occasions when Washington's forces and forces of other American generals commanding separately from Washington were successful against British forces. But more commonly, when there were battles between the Americans and the British during the Revolution, the British forces won. They were professional. They were professionally generaled and so on. And Washington's experience at the beginning of the war was that he had been a militia major several years earlier. America didn't have any professional generals. It didn't have an officer class. It couldn't really hope to win a war like that. At the beginning of 1776, Thomas Paine published a pamphlet called Common Sense. And in this pamphlet, he explained that the independence of the United States was essential and that it was mandated by common sense. He said, "Does it make any sense that a small island off the north coast of Europe should govern an entire continent 3,000 miles away?" Well, no, obviously. The continent should be independent of the island. It's common sense. Did it make any sense that monarchy should be the form of government of North America? That monarchy commonly, even in the case where you had an outstandingly able king, led to government by somebody substantially less able. Occasionally you'd have a child king, and then you might have one who was notably mentally deficient or who certainly didn't have any skill in statecraft or war making. So Paine's conclusion was, well, monarchy doesn't make any sense. And then he went on to talk commonsensically it should be rejected as a model of government. And then he went on to talk about the British monarchy itself, which he said had originated in conquest of England by a French banditti, that was his word for it, in 1066. And he says this is a Norman bastard invading England and killing the English king and all the English nobles. Is this a government that comes to us from God? He says, certainly this is a most paltry, rascally original. It hath no divinity in it. So this all should be rejected. It was just common sense. Well, up to this point, as I've explained, people were relatively loath to declare independence. But when Common Sense was published at the beginning of 1776, it was widely read. In fact, it became the most popular American publication of the 18th century. Ultimately, even though the population of white people in these 13 colonies was about 2.5 million at the time the Revolution began, it seems that Common Sense sold as many as 400,000 copies. So just imagine a book that sold one copy to every 6 people who were among the potential readership. And that doesn't, you know, that ignores the fact that some substantial portion of those 2.5 million would have been children too young to read, or illiterate people outside New England, where literacy was far less likely than it was in New England. Anyway, a substantial portion, an overwhelming share of the American population read Common Sense. When George Washington read it, he was so excited by it that he, at the time, had his men called out on the parade ground on the Bowling Green in New York City at the south end of Manhattan, and had the officers read Common Sense to their men, at which point it seems that the American soldiery decided, well, independence was a good idea. So Congress, following all this, decided finally, at the instigation of Virginia, which already had established its independence by adopting a permanent Republican constitution before this happened, but in June of 1776, a Virginia congressman moved that these colonies aren't of right ought to be free and independent states. So Congress appointed a committee of 5 men to draft a declaration of independence, that is, recognizing the independence of these North American colonies. The chief penman of the Declaration of Independence, of course, was Thomas Jefferson, who began by laying out an argument that everybody's entitled to self-government. That's the sense in which all men are created equal. They're entitled to self-government. Government is created by men to protect their rights, and in case it fails to do that, men are entitled to replace the government that's failed them with a new government more suitable to their purposes. The Declaration then went on to list numerous ways in which it said that the King of England, not the Parliament, because Parliament's authority was already rejected by the American populace at large, but they said that the King had failed to live up to his obligations to them. And so then they also said, it's not that we've never pointed this out to our brethren in England, but they've ignored us, and so we have to denounce them as enemies in war and in peace friends, just like everybody else. And finally, the Declaration closed by saying that these colonies are and of right ought to be, as Virginia had instructed Richard Henry Lee to say, free and independent states. There you had the Declaration of Independence, this joint product of all the 13 colonies. The American war, essentially the war effort, ultimately was decided by the willingness of the American populace to bear a long, grueling struggle. It began in 1775 with promises that it would be short, and it lasted until 1783. Really, the fighting ended more or less in 1781. But for 6 years, there was fighting up and down the East Coast, which then was the settled area of what we now call the United States. So the fighting was across American territory, and towns all over North America were burned down by the British. Towns in Massachusetts, in Connecticut, in Virginia were burned down as part of British policy, and Americans suffered interruption of their trade. They couldn't export, they couldn't import, they couldn't get money because they could. If you're a farmer and you can't send your crop off to market, if you can't sell your rice where you've been used to selling it, or you can't sell your tobacco or your flour from wheat or whatever it is you're selling, then what can you do for money? Well, the Americans were very hard up during the war. This, besides the fact that the army might be marching through and burning your house down or ruining your crops, killing your livestock, killing your father, killing your uncle, killing your brother, still the Americans put up with this through many, many years of struggle. And in the end, a second British army finally, after 1777 at Saratoga, in 1781, At Yorktown, Virginia, a second British army was made to surrender, and at that point, the Prime Minister, who had been telling the King for years, this war can't be won, the Prime Minister, Lord North, went to King George and said, "I am resigning, Your Majesty. I will not stay in this position." He had tried to resign before when he decided the war was going to be lost, but the King wouldn't accept his resignation. At this point, the King recognized reality and accepted Lord North's resignation. Ultimately, the Treaty of Paris in 1783, which ended the war formally, proved to be the biggest diplomatic success in American history, and it was thanks largely to John Jay of New York, who was among the three men sent to France to negotiate this treaty, because Jay insisted on a broad boundary for the United States. And England, for reasons that have never been clear, and actually which shocked, in a move that shocked America's chief ally, France, England agreed that the western boundary of the United States should be not the Appalachians, which was the extent of settlement, but the Mississippi River. So basically, at a stroke, the British doubled the size of American territory, thereby ensuring that America was going to become a great power. And that's exactly what happened in the wake of the war.